It was obviously in the news, of course, and that was one of the big legal stories of the week. President Biden officially nominated Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. She's been on the D.C. Court of Appeals for just about a year, maybe 10 months was when her confirmation was. If you're curious, she got 53 votes in the Senate. She got some bipartisan support in the Senate. 44 senators voted against her. Obviously, we'll wait and see if there's going to be any bipartisan support. They don't need it. They only need 50 senators now after Mitch McConnell changed the rules with the so-called nuclear option years ago I believe that was for Neil Gorsuch to be able to get that Supreme Court justice approved. And we can go down the list of who changed the rules. Obviously, Harry Reid, the Democrat, changed the rules for appellate judges. Anyways, we don't want to play that game. Anyways, Ketanji Brown Jackson is officially the nominee. Yesterday, President Biden said at the White House, "Today, as we watch freedom and liberty under attack abroad, I'm here to fulfill my responsibilities under the Constitution to preserve freedom and liberty here in the United States of America." It was interesting. She admitted, I believe, that one of her relatives is serving a life sentence for a drug crime, and also has some uncles and I believe a brother she mentioned as well serving as a police officer. She's 51 years old. Obviously, age a big consideration now as presidents want to nominate people that'll be there for decades. And we will continue on this program to watch this nomination process. Much of the nomination process is very political, and that's not what this show is. So as we go through it, and they hope to have a vote perhaps by mid-April, in the coming weeks, we will analyze this from a legal perspective. But I really don't want to bring the politics into this. So we will stay away from that on this program. We will analyze what's happening in the Senate, but we'll do it from a legal perspective. President Biden, in his remarks, as you heard, mentioning freedom and liberty under attack abroad. And that has been the big story overall this week. And I really wanted to dive into the international law world, right? Because these laws are a little, I don't want to say they're more nebulous, but they often get challenged a lot. Sovereignty from a country often seen maybe as more important by some countries than international law. So I had a great chance to talk to Mary Ellen O'Connell. She's a professor of law and research professor of international dispute resolution at the University of Notre Dame. She's the author of The Crisis in Ukraine, the editor of the book What is War? And I started our conversation, we chatted yesterday, about the UN versus NATO. Who controls what? Who can do what? And really the line between those two and where we go moving forward.
It's an interesting point of law, and I'm glad you asked about it because I think there's a lot of need to understand it better. The most important document governing this entire situation is the United Nations Charter, drafted after the Second World War, adopted 1945. It's been what so many refer to as the basis of the rules-based order since the Second World War. At the heart of the UN Charter is Article 2, Paragraph 4, which strictly prohibits the general use of military force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. All members of the UN, and I think even broader, even non-members such as Taiwan, have the protection of that general prohibition on the use of force. There are only two express exceptions to that prohibition also in the Charter. One is for Security Council authorization. So if the Security Council authorizes a use of force, then it is lawful for states to act under that authorization. And that's what happened, for example, in 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait and attempted to obliterate it, to eliminate it as a sovereign state. The United Nations Security Council came together in unanimity and authorized a use of force to liberate Kuwait. That's not going to happen this time because right. One of the permanent members of the Security Council is Russia. The alternative when that happens is that every state also has the right, expressly stated in the Charter, to act in individual and collective self-defense of their territory if an armed attack occurs. Plainly, Ukraine is in a situation where Russia is attacking it. So it has the right to act in self-defense, and it may invite any other state to come in and assist it. The one thing is, John, neither the Security Council nor, in the absence of the Security Council, the General Assembly doesn't have the authority to require states to come to the aid of Ukraine. They can do so voluntarily, but they don't have to. And the United States has made the decision that it's too dangerous. It could spark a yet more catastrophic war if the United States comes to the collective self-defense of Ukraine, as of course Ukraine would like. That's where NATO comes in. In order to ensure that states would come to the assistance of a state that's been attacked, especially during the Cold War, when the fear in Western Europe is that the Soviet Union would cross boundaries and attempt to take over countries. For that reason, in order to have the guarantee of collective self-defense, the NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty, was adopted. Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty references the self-defense provisions of the UN Charter, Article 51. And it says expressly, if there's an attack on one, it is an attack on all. And we have a legal obligation under this treaty, the NATO treaty, to come to the aid of our members who have been attacked. That's why Ukraine wanted to be a member of NATO, so it would have that treaty protection. It doesn't have it. But look at the Baltics. They have it. They are so worried about Russia coming in, but they have this sense of security that NATO will defend them.
Because if Russia went into one of those nations, the theory could be, you know, right, mutually assured destruction. Now we have a full-on world war that nobody is going to come out cleanly from.
We, the United States, respects international law and our treaty obligations sufficiently that we will go to their defense. Hopefully, the knowledge that the U.S. will come to the defense of these countries is strong enough in Putin's mind that he won't tempt this further. I wouldn't rule out more indirect ways of expanding his hegemonic notions of what greater Russia should be, but I don't think he will try a full assault, a full-scale invasion the way he is in Ukraine. And I'm still hopeful that he'll realize the costs of global opprobrium and increasing levels of sanctions and other measures against him will be great enough that he'll pull back and we'll have at least some surviving Ukraine and a surviving Ukrainian independent government to continue to work diplomatically to liberate the rest of the country.
So geographically, Ukraine is in the middle, but quite figuratively, they're just in the middle. They're not in NATO. They don't have those protections. It didn't force us to help them. The UN charter only works if the Security Council is in lockstep, and obviously Russia, one of those members, is not going to be part of that. So I feel like that's why so many of us watch helplessly, right?
I think this is one place where the U.S. has failed to lead sufficiently, but we may see a reversal soon. There's a General Assembly in addition to the Security Council. The General Assembly is that collective membership, every one of the UN members, all 193. They can't order or mandate a use of force, authorize force, the way the Security Council can, but they can coordinate global sanctions against Russia, and that could be truly important. Right now, I think the United States has taken quite tepid measures. We're hearing some criticisms of President Biden, and I share those. Already in 2014, when Russia first used force against Ukraine and occupied unlawfully the peninsula of Crimea, at that point, all purchases of Russian oil and gas should have been cut. That would have been a great burden, especially in the winter. Remember, it was February 2014. President Obama backed off. I think that was a mistake. That would have been the lowest cost point in time to use. Cutting oil and gas purchases would have sent the Russian economy into a tailspin. Putin, early, before he was too dug in, would have been able to pull back and just say, we were trying to protect human rights. We
he
didn't
could
do
have saved
it then.
Face. He could have saved face locally.
Exactly. Okay. It was the right time. The week that it happened, those severe sanctions, those really biting sanctions should have gone in as a measure of collective self-defense with Ukraine. Now, we're still not doing it. I don't want to hear any more about Nord Stream 2. It was delivering no oil. It was paying no money into the Russian treasury. I think it's important that it was suspended. It's not the same as cutting fuel purchases. And once again, we know that it will hurt. It will hurt in the United States. We heard President Biden very worried that Americans won't vote for Democrats in the fall because they have to pay more for gas. How about defending the rule of law in the world by paying more for gasoline? We're not sending our young people to fight and die in Europe the way we did in the First World War and the Second World War. We're asking Americans to pay a few dollars more at the pump for gas.
And it's one of those things where, you know, you talk about legacies, you talk about the importance of the global scene. It might be worth losing a re-election over something like this, as some could argue, certainly.
Let's see some stature. Let's see some principle. let's see, we've seen President Zelensky, who has told his nation and the world he expects to be killed, that he has a target on his head, and we can't support him and his people in defending what are their rights, and by the same token, the rights of all nations in the world. We begin to give in to law violators of the magnitude of Vladimir Putin. We invite other law violators to carry out similar violations of the same nature. I want to quote from Ukraine's foreign minister, who was speaking to the Security Council, and he said, Putin is trying to prove that the UN is weak, indecisive, and unable to defend its core principles. And he warned that if member states fail to hold Russia accountable, Russia's acts of aggression will inspire others to follow suit. We know that that is true. If you do not act to preserve the law, it becomes a dead letter, and others will walk right over it and perpetrate more wrongs. We've got to take a stand on the principle. We don't have to go so far as to risk young people's lives in Ukraine. We can pay more money at the pump.
That's Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell from the University of Notre Dame. After the news, I'm going to chat with her a little bit about the UN. And can Russia get kicked out of the UN? Will that do any good? And what's next in this crisis? We'll get to that after the news here on WGN. Let's get legal. I feel like we've done everything on this show from the court perspective. We talked about local and federal courts with Michael Leonard, and now we're talking about international courts, international laws with Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell of the University of Notre Dame. She's the author of The Crisis in Ukraine. She's the editor of the book What is War? And previously served as a professional military educator for the U.S. Department of Defense. So as people might disagree with her, as I see on the text line, no one can question her credentials on what she knows about what is happening over there and from an international law perspective. And right, international law is a confusing and sort of nebulous world. Right? These are laws that are written down that countries have agreed to, but they don't always do what they said they were going to do. And we'll put the United States in that camp too. Violations of international law, but done for reasons that the country justified to itself or to its own people. And maybe there was a good reason. I don't know, right? Those are debates to have. But certainly there's a lot of unanimity against what Russia is doing right now. And I wanted to ask her if there was any international law way out of this. And I guess what I mean by that is, obviously, there's use of force to try and stop Russia from going into Ukraine, but the possibility of the United States or NATO getting involved in that could escalate things into literally the Third World War and nuclear war, and nobody wants that. So is there a diplomatic way out of this? And here's what she chatted about.
The other thing that has just happened, and so gives me some hope of a possible shorter term rather than longer term resolution, President Zelensky of Ukraine has offered to negotiate the possibility of a future state of Ukraine that is neutral, much like Finland. And Russia has apparently made some overture that they could negotiate. So that gave me some hope today. Also, despite my rather stark dual pictures of the future, one completely negative, kind of a really obliterated, chaotic world order, and one far more orderly and moving toward a better future, we can never give up. This is our only world. The children of this planet deserve our constant efforts to try to build a more prosperous, healthy planet for them to inherit. So even if it's the dark scenario that I painted, in the short run, everyone with a chance to contribute to a better future, whether through the ballot box in their own nations or through writing and speaking, if they're academics or if they're in the media, to try to constantly recall what we did envision at the end of the Second World War, what we did envision after Kuwait was liberated. President George H.W. Bush promised a new world order under the rule of law. We need to go back to that vision. America owes redress for its own violations of that New World Order in the years after President Bush. But most of all, we've got to get going forward compliance, strict compliance, and an end to this kind of a violence that Russia is perpetrating. You mentioned a couple of times how much this could expand, and that vision of the Ukrainian foreign minister that others could follow suit. It could be even worse than the dark picture. We're very worried about China possibly taking this occasion to use force to absorb Taiwan. There are many other conflictual territorial boundary situations that more strawmen, more of these authoritarian militarists could take advantage of this moment. So we've got to stay on the path of trying to rebuild the rule of law, to restore in the United States. I think we've lost a lot of our fundamental knowledge of what international law requires. We got very carried away, I would say, with what the United States could do in the world on its own without really heeding the world's law. One of my long-standing complaints is that we don't take international law seriously when we teach it in many of our law schools. That all could be restored as part of this post-Ukraine effort to restore the rule of law in the world, the law we need to tackle the problems that, you know, our climate change, prosperity. Look at the levels of poverty in the world. Look at the next pandemic that we know is coming. These are the kinds of problems we should be working cooperatively using law and institutions going forward, and not creating these disasters of armed conflict with real risks of nuclear exchange.
Professor, I think while we've probably just scratched the surface, of course, of what you know and everything, I think that's a good place to leave it for now. Perhaps we can catch up again in the coming weeks as we see what happens next, okay?
I would appreciate that, and I really thought this was an important conversation. Thanks, John.
Yeah, I think it was an important conversation, too. The professor and I, in talking yesterday, she had mentioned right at the beginning of that about Zelensky considering the idea of Ukraine being a neutral party, a neutral country like Finland is. And you might say, well, isn't Ukraine neutral? I think what the distinction is Ukraine has always been pushing to join the West into NATO, to want to separate further from Russia and from the communist ideals of Russia. And perhaps if they took a more Finland approach, which is we're just not going to do anything. We're going to be, I don't want to say it like that, but we're going to be who we are and we don't have any desire to join NATO, whatever the case, perhaps Russia would pull back. That was news yesterday. He said in a video address Friday night, Ukrainian time, he was not afraid to discuss with Russians the issue of Ukraine's neutral status. So she was commenting on one possible way out of it. But boy, it's an important conversation. And international law is something that I have to admit I know little about. I know about the UN and NATO. I don't think I've ever read the Charter, NATO Accords, or anything along those lines. But it's something we could all study up on a little bit. Judith, I wanted to get on Judith on the line. Judith, you were calling. What did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I do, and I understand the professor is a citizen and is working under the constraints of being so. But if I remember correctly, the president has, and I don't know the exact word, but it is a process that has been used many times before and in the current memory.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just call it pathological extermination, where it is actually legally sanctioned for the U.S. president to go in and into a country, and I'm not talking about working under the constraints of NATO.
Are you saying, Judith, that you want the president to send troops into Ukraine?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
I am saying that the person who has started all of this.
President Putin?
I don't understand why he is still living.
Oh, I think okay.
Legally, the president can order a sanction on his life.
You're saying assassinate President Putin is what you're saying, Judith.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know. I know there are a lot of, in fact, executive orders against doing that. I don't know that world of law. I don't think it's easy. I don't know if that's a great option, but I appreciate the phone call. Yeah, I mean, that would be certainly an extreme measure. I don't know if it's possible to even do that. I know that we've talked in history classes about attempts on Fidel Castro and Central and Southern American countries. I don't know. I'm sure in a room somewhere they're talking about it, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to even speculate on that. But I do appreciate the perspective. Everyone has some idea, perhaps, and someone's talking about things somewhere. Anyways, let's take a quick break. We'll wrap things up next on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN.